Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. As you're running around in last-minute holiday shopping and errands looking for parking, we'll begin by talking about parking here on this edition of the South Florida Roundup. Paying for public parking in Miami, it's going to go up in the new year unless you use the city's choice parking app. But if you do, you may be sharing some of your personal data as well. This month, the Miami City Commissioners okayed new parking prices for 2019. If you don't live in the city, you could pay $3 or more per hour to park on the street in some areas. If you live in the city and register your car through the pay-by-phone parking app, you'll keep paying $1.40 an hour everywhere. Parking in city garages also will be going up in price. Now, these are the first price hikes for parking in the city of Miami since 2009. It could bring in $10 million a year in extra revenue. What if you don't pay? Well, the county controls parking fines, and those fines also are going up beginning in July of next year. Expired meter fines will almost double from $18 to $32. Of course, there are actually few real parking meters left anymore anywhere in South Florida. There are parking kiosks, but increasingly drivers like Nelson from Miami have to use a parking app to pay all across South Florida.
After going to Wynwood for Art Basel Week, we stopped at a spot on the street, got the number off of the sign, typed it into our app, and paid for our time. Upon returning to our vehicle with plenty of time left, we got a ticket. Turns out that the code on the sign was registered to a different address. We will not be fighting it to waste half a day at court and pay parking in downtown. Rather just pay the $35 and just be done with it.
So have you had a rough time paying for parking through an app? How concerned are you about privacy when using that parking app to pay for parking? 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number. 800-743-9576 to share your parking stories with us. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Are you prepared to pay for higher prices to park in the city of Miami in the new year? Janet in South Miami sent us this text. The app is frozen half the time or it can't find your location. I've gotten several tickets because of it. My parents, who are elderly, could never do it. It is a task every time they park. Ashley in Pembroke Pines. I run into this issue at the Hollywood Beach parking garage where the code for the machine cannot be found in the app. Therefore, I can't pay. I constantly have to then go to the meter, pay using regular cards or cash, which is more expensive. 800-743-9576. 800-743-WLRN, the telephone number. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Danny Rivero has been watching this parking situation develop over the past several months in the city of Miami and elsewhere. He is with us here in our downtown studios. So, Danny, let's just start here in the city of Miami. Explain the parking price changes that are going to happen in the new year.
Right. Like, so you mentioned the parking rates had not been increased in the city of Miami for really quite some time. And after looking at it and doing some studies, the city actually realized that regionally and nationally, the parking rates here were actually very low in the city of Miami. So this was both an effort to raise some revenue through raising the cost and also to kind of get the city up to the level of where other cities are.
Yeah, I think anybody who has parked in a major metropolitan city arguably would say that parking in the city of Miami, on-street parking, is relatively cheap, certainly compared to New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, those kinds of places. But nonetheless, a parking price hike that may be significant for some people. So what's the impact for drivers in terms of how they choose to pay for parking?
So if you are not a resident of the city of Miami, you can pretty much go about however you were doing it. If you were using any street meter you might be able to find, you can do that. You can use the pay-by-phone app. Now, the differential here really comes for the city of Miami residents. If you are a city of Miami resident in an effort for the commission to kind of appease their own
constituents, yeah.
They said, look, we're going to offer city residents their own rate. So it's going to be a $1.40 rate across the city, which is in some cases cheaper than what people are paying now.
Yeah.
But the catch is the only way to get that is to register through the pay-by-phone app. And that's an app. You have to have a smartphone, so Android, iPhone. You have to download it, input all your information, input your your license plate information into it. Now, this app is owned by Volkswagen, which is the largest car manufacturer in the world, and it's pretty explicitly shares that data that it collects with other people.
Yeah. What does it say in the terms of service in regards to personal data? When everybody downloads the app, or if you download the app, and it's not just the city of Miami that uses the Pay by Phone app, a number of municipalities do, and there's a couple of different types of parking apps out there, but you tend to download it when your car is waiting and you got to get to your meeting or whatever it is you're parking for, and you click yes to agree to the terms of service, and then you move on with your life. But what are we actually agreeing to?
Well, you're agreeing that your information can be shared with third parties. That means possibly other companies, other government agencies, law enforcement. Mm. This is the kind of thing that can be subpoenaed. Say someone's going through a divorce and your current spouse wants to know where you've been parking. Well, they can subpoena that.
So the price of privacy and parking convenience here with these parking apps, 800-743-WLRN, the telephone number, 800-743-9576. Also send us your parking stories on Twitter, at WLRN. Get your phone calls coming up in just a matter of moments here. Danny Rivero with WLRN is with us again. So how does the app work for folks who are not city residents? And what are they going to face in 2019? Just a higher fee based on location, right?
Yeah, a higher fee based on location. If you're not registered through the city with the app, that you have an address within the city limits, then you're going to be charged the new rates, which varies depending on the neighborhood. One thing I would add to what we were just talking about is, so we've setting up this program this way where you have to register through the app actually poses a little bit of a burden for some of the poorest city residents. Not everyone has a cell phone necessarily, or if you have a cell phone, not everyone has a smartphone.
Right.
And a lot of people who are in these lower kind of the more impoverished people, mm-hmm. not everyone has a bank account.
Right.
And
because the app only works with some kind of credit card or debit card, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I posed this question to the Miami Parking Authority, just saying like, how is this going to be rolled out if someone doesn't have, if someone's unbanked,
yeah.
How are they going to do this? And they said, well, if they don't have a credit card or a debit card, they're going to have to pay the increased rates because there's no way that they can register get this.
And some of those kiosks only take credit cards. They don't take cash either.
That's true.
There's that too. And, you know, in regards to the actual device that you need now to park, the smartphone, number of folks may pay for data. So they're concerned about, you know, how much uploading and downloading they're using on those smartphones. And every time you open that app, you're going to be starting to run the ticker on the data that you're using on your cell phone plan.
That's exactly true. And that's talking to some of the experts that I've talked to for this, technology policy experts. I mean, this is one thing they've said, you know, we're in a position where the internet is nearly ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really considered a right. I mean, there's not publicly available mobile data coverage.
Yeah.
But
it's not regulated like a public utility is.
Exactly.
Right.
But it's increasingly being merged with basic city services. I mean, parking on the street is the most basic of city services. And if your ability to park on the street is predicated on them assuming that you have internet access, there's a gap there.
Yeah. 800-743-9576. Your parking stories, love, hate the app, privacy versus price using parking apps throughout South Florida, the hunt for a kiosk on the block, for instance, to pay. Let's begin in Delray Beach. John on line one. Go ahead, John. Your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I happen to be a big proponent of it. And I've put three different apps on my phone because, as you mentioned, various cities and communities have different apps. But Park Mobile and Pay by Phone are the ones in West Palm, Fort Lauderdale, Miami.
Yeah.
And Delray actually now has Park Mobile. There's also, I think this is really becoming much more important, is private lots now, which are typically open only during the daytime for office buildings and all, are now, because of the app, being able to open at night and weekends for general public parking.
Mm.
And they can use an app. So there's like Pay by Park, which is a private company that's doing that on private lots, but that's putting a lot more spaces into the public realm that weren't available until the app was. So I think it's great. I mean, To be honest with you, the other thing I wish were more ubiquitous was the Sun Pass. As you know, you could go into the airports now in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and West Palm, and you could enter the parking garages with Sun Pass. And that is tied to your Sun Pass account, and it just bills to that. So any way you can make it simpler and easier and quicker for people to park and pay, the number of people that pay is significantly higher that use apps than people who pay with a meter.
Yeah.
And so that cuts down on the amount of tickets.
Yeah.
It cuts down on the amount of enforcement. It's just, I just find it to be extremely easy.
John, just speaking like a parking professional there in Delray, you've got all three apps ready to roll in your SunPass. John, thanks for sharing your thoughts. Bradford from Miami sent us this tweet from Miami Lakes. Never had an issue with the app. Easy and convenient, not concerned about privacy. People worry too much, Bradford writes us. Ulf in Miami wrote us, the inability to pay with cash means that one's movements get tracked. Add to that the fact that one must travel with a cell phone. Pure 1984 is what Ulf texted us. Ruben in Aventura on line two. Ruben, thanks for calling in. Go ahead, your thoughts.
Hey, thank you for having me, guys. I am very much with John from Del Rey about the convenience and the practicality of the app. I actually, my wife's from Australia. I'm originally from Venezuela, but live here in Miami. And we travel all over the world. So far in the States, in Canada, in Australia, I can use the same app that we use here in Miami. There is a sense of practicality as far as being able to load funds into the app. So now every time that I use the parking meter in any, well, quote-unquote parking meter around the world, I don't have to worry about individual credit card transaction fees. Instead, it just gets taken out directly from my from the app balance.
Yeah,
so that's quite convenient. As far as there is a bit of a sense of privilege, if you will, that I think it's kind of one of the concerns as far as being able to pay with a credit card. But I have friends who are not maybe as well off as I am, and I don't think I'm doing. I'm not in the top 1%, if you will. But I have a number of friends that are not as financially fluent as I am.
Yeah.
And while they may not have a credit card or even a bank account, they you know, I think they find their way to make this payment. There's prepaid credit cards or gift cards that are Visa or MasterCard or even American Express enabled that you can use to make this type of payments.
Ruben, I appreciate your thoughts. Thanks for joining us and sharing that perspective from Aventura. Danny Rivero, Miami, I think, was one of the first, the city, one of the first municipalities to sign on to this pay-by-phone parking app many, many years ago. And it is the majority of the way people are paying for parking in Miami by a long shot, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. According to the Miami Parking Authority, 88% of transactions currently are run through the pay by phone app. Now, there's also been a little bit of engineering as to how they got there. You know, over the last decade, they started this program a decade ago. They've eliminated half of the multi-space machines in the streets.
The kiosks. I call them kiosks.
Yeah, we can call them kiosks.
Okay.
So they've eliminated half of those, which means there's areas of the city where, I mean, the only way you can pay is through the app, but there's not a meter you can run your credit card through or put some cash into. And they've also eliminated almost all of the single spot meters.
I mean,
almost nobody uses those.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of the technology becoming more ubiquitous and also, you know, just
the only way to pay.
Yeah. Just taking out the physical machines.
Yeah. Carter in Miami, your thoughts on parking, Carter. Thanks for calling in.
Good afternoon, guys. Well, first of all, the previous caller or person that sent a tweet about people worry too much, get your information violated and see how you feel after that. But Miami in particular, the parking is a joke. It's horrible. If you look at a place like Brickell, the opportunity was there for them to kind of get it right. And I understand that they are pushing this whole tram system that they have. But if you're coming from outside Brickell, where do you park to get this? So all these building structures that are there now, I'm looking for the municipal parking, and I'm really not seeing it. In regards to the app, let's take a look at Facebook and what's happened there in the last year or two. The amount of data breaches, the amount of evil ways that our information is being used. I'm curious to find out, as you've already mentioned, how does this take place with this app? Has there been a breakdown even to see exactly, all right, so obviously there needs to be a location-based permission for specifically Android devices.
Yeah.
But beyond that, what happens, is there a way for the app to have access to your contacts? You know, what about private messages, emails, all these different things? So these are some serious questions that I think need to be addressed. And I hope that it does. And,
Carter, has this affected where you park or how you pay for parking?
It has to a degree. You know, unfortunately, we are now in a place where you're kind of forced into using these tools. So, I, of course, like all the other callers and many other people have been, had to use it, but I'm not completely happy about it.
Carter, thanks for sharing your perspective. Appreciate your phone call here today. Danny Rivera, we have to leave it there. Next time, we need to talk about the narrowing width of parking spaces in Miami. I am convinced they're getting narrower and narrower, or maybe I'm just getting bigger and bigger. I'm not sure which.
It's like airplane seats.
I think it is. Danny Rivera here talking about parking in the city of Miami and elsewhere on parking apps. Thanks for your work in journalism, Danny. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
We got plenty more to come here. Stick with us. Our higher seas leading to higher real estate prices on higher ground. That's next as the roundup continues. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening and supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson. Life in South Florida revolves around water. The seas are expected to rise by as much as 2 feet, maybe a little bit more, in the next 40 years. And real estate-driven South Florida, is that leading to rising prices for real estate on higher ground? Well, those communities here historically have been home to black and minority neighborhoods. It's what some call climate gentrification. Caroline Lewis founded the environmental nonprofit called the Clio Institute in Miami. She explains climate gentrification by looking at Miami-Dade County's geography and topography. There's a ridge that sits in the middle of the county where the railroad was put.
So this ridge that is 15 to 18 to 20 feet above sea level in parts is like the Rocky Mountains for down here. And so people, developers, are looking at elevation more and more for several reasons. Do you want to buy and build on low-lying areas and have to account for that sea level rise and pay higher insurance, or do you want to get on the ridge?
That has community organizers like Valencia Gunder concerned. Here she is speaking at a panel on climate gentrification in August.
People do want a better life, but people do want to stay in their communities. When we see the road works being done, we see the new buildings popping up, we see the old buildings being knocked down, we know that these new buildings are not for us.
The cost of living by the water now. Have you been seeing the effects of sea level rise in your community? Has that affected your long-term plans for staying in South Florida? How could climate change reshape real estate here in our region, and what role does race play in all of this? 800-743-WLRN is our phone number. To join the conversation, share your perspective from your neighborhood, 800-743-9576. Also send us a tweet at WLRN. We've got Nadege Green, WLRN reporter, with us here downtown, and from our studios inside the Miami Herald in Doral is Alex Harris. She covers climate change for our partner, the Miami Herald. Alex, let's start with you here. Voters in the city of Miami a couple of elections ago approved borrowing a couple hundred million dollars, a portion of which is supposed to go to flood control projects, stormwater, and seawalls, maybe raising streets. And the city formally, within the last week or so, approved the first set of borrowing of several million dollars. And a portion of that's going to go towards studying climate gentrification. What does that look like for the city? What is the city after in this study, and how's it going to go do it?
So a lot of details of that are kind of unclear. So of that Miami Forever bond you're talking about, that's $192 million for these kind of projects. And the latest group we saw earlier a couple weeks ago was $10 million. And some of that was a little bit put aside to help people in these rapidly gentrifying communities afford to live there, maybe a little extra money to help them repair their houses and they can stay there a little bit longer. But as for what this study looks like, there weren't a lot of details when I talked to Jane Gilbert, the city's resilience officer. It kind of looks like it's going to fold into the work they're already doing, trying to come up with solutions for affordable housing in general. So they're going to try to look at what they've already have going on. And the first step, I think, is identifying the neighborhoods that are most at risk. So ideally, we think of high elevation, low income neighborhoods are the most at risk for this phenomena.
So, Nadege Green, if the city studies this, what are some of the stories, the anecdotal stories that they'll hear?
I think one of the things we're hearing from residents, at least, is that the pressure point, right, for the prices in the neighborhood are climbing. Even among real estate agents, you're hearing people want to know about elevation when they're buying homes. So as a result of that, folks who are living in these communities, their homes are valued more, not only because they're close to the urban core, which is part of this story, is that these are neighborhoods that once were ignored, but because they're close to downtown Miami-ish and Wynwood, et cetera, is too expensive, people want to live there because of proximity, yep. But also because it doesn't flood. So they'll probably hear stories if they talk to real estate agents of people asking those type of questions. And they'll hear stories from community members, residents who in many of these neighborhoods, for example, like Liberty City, Little Haiti, are some of the areas where there's already naturally occurring affordable housing, where you can still find things slightly below market rate or at market rate. And those type of apartments and living quarters are disappearing from the market with no replacements.
Yeah, what's the manifestation of this as Nadege of speculators or developers or even potential homeowners have discovered elevation as a component of their calculation? What are those homeowners who've had these homes, in some cases generations, going back several generations, what are they experiencing?
I think the home... It's less of a pressure point for homeowners, though I am hearing from homeowners, for example, in Little Haiti, where you are seeing speculators show up at your doorsteps, where people are knocking on your door, not just sending you letters saying, hey, would you like to sell your home? You're getting like telemarketers show up to your door to be like, hey, would you like to sell your home? Multiple occasions I've had homeowners tell me that. But I think that's less of an issue for them because they own their home and they can make a decision either way. I think more of the pressure is on renters, people who don't own, right, and who have no control over that. And so when you're seeing your rent climb, or maybe a landlord who was once a slumlord, which is why your apartment was below market values because they would not upgrade where you're living, all of a sudden say, hey, I want to take this building and fix it up so that it can be valued at market rate. What happens to the people who live there and we're paying $600, $800 a month for a studio?
So, Alex, are developers, are they sensing an advantage in the marketplace here? In other words, elevation, or is this, in your estimation, really being driven by climate change and concern about the possibility of dwindling market values closer to the sea in the decades ahead?
So that's actually a really tough question to figure out. I mean, what we've seen in the research is a look at a Harvard research study that kind of has been the one everyone talks about when you talk about climate gentrification in Miami-Dade County, found that these areas that we're talking about saw a much greater value jump over the years than their more low elevation places. And it was a look at single family homes. So that research kind of shows that, yeah, people who are looking for a home may be more likely to choose these places. But the author of the study, Jesse Keenan, has pushed back on the idea that developers maybe are also following that same path. Mm. And when he talked to the real estate industry, they push back really hard on this. They say, oh, no. Elevation's interesting or a factor, or it's something we're maybe considering. But, you know, they keep saying the same old things that are important: access to transportation, location. So if you ask many developers, they won't tell you that this is happening. I spoke to George Perez, spoke to David Martin, others in the real estate industry since this study came out this summer, and they all say the same thing. They say, oh, that sounds interesting, but no, we don't think that's happening.
George Perez, the condo king of South Florida, has reshaped the skyline in South Florida, not just in Dade County, but building along the ocean in Broward and Palm Beach County as well. We spoke to him as well in October, I think it was. And to us, he acknowledged that sea level rise and climate change are something he thinks about. He's worried about it, but it hasn't affected his appetite for developing properties on the waterfront.
I mean, but if I have great beachfront locations, I will definitely still build on the beachfront, because our greatest asset and our greatest attraction to South Florida is the water.
And as long as the buyers are still there to pay a higher price than what the developers are buying and building for, Alex, the economic incentive is to continue to build there.
Right. And then, but what you hear from the other side of it is the people. Like, does it really matter what the developers say, the reason they're buying in your neighborhood? The effect is the same, right?
Yeah,
you're
right.
Still getting displaced.
And Nadege, to your point about the points here of pressure immediately or close to immediately affecting renters, certainly, because that's a much more flexible cost versus a homeowner, somebody who has owned their home, doesn't have a mortgage on it. That could be years down the road, or even maybe just 18 months down the road, if that property price, the underlying price or value, continues to increase exponentially, and then you get the tax roll effect 18 months later. then that puts those incomes, and a lot of times some fixed incomes, under significant pressure.
Absolutely. And that is already happening. I mean, when you look at Little Haiti, for example, yep. when you go around Little Haiti and you look at the for sale signs, it's not just home for sale. It might be a dilapidated structure. It says land for sale, right? Because there is a lot happening in that community. There's a lot changing. And it is definitely going to impact how people exist or whether they can even exist in that community anymore.
We're talking about climate gentrification in South Florida, rising seas leading to rising prices on higher ground. What are your thoughts? 800-743-9576, looking to sell a lower elevation piece of property that maybe you've lived in and trying to move to higher ground, or not concerned at all. 800-743-9576 or at WLRN. Speaking with Nadege Green of WLRN and Alex Harris, who covers climate change for our partner, the Miami Herald. Let's talk about affordable housing here, specifically as it relates to this issue in these neighborhoods. Alex, you mentioned the Miami GO bond, the Forever bond, which includes a portion of affordable housing money. How is all of this kind of manifesting itself and coming together in some of these neighborhoods?
So in these neighborhoods, you know, like Nadege was talking about, these renters are the ones that are facing more stress because their buildings can get sold out right from under them. But we're seeing a really huge change in value underneath them. Something I had in a story recently is that Little Haiti has seen a 1,121% increase in owner-occupied units worth more than $150,000. And that's just from 2014. A woman I talked to in Liberty City has seen her house that she bought in 2001 for $90,000 is now worth $250,000. Hmm. These values are just climbing like crazy.
And what's driving that? I mean, obviously there's got to be comps, right? Comparables where there was actually a closed deal that the real estate industry can point to, that woman who had the $90,000 home that's now $250,000.
It's really the perfect storm that's happening right now. A, it's the availability of single family homes.
Very tight, yeah.
It's very tight, right? So neighborhoods that still have them, people are looking at them now because you can't find a home really under $400,000 in some of the more affluent areas or the schools with the better parks and the better school districts, right? And so it's like, what's your plan B? What's your plan C? Yeah. So that is happening at the same time that you have people wanting to move closer to the urban core. And that is happening at the same time where people are considered on elevation and whether or not a neighborhood floods. And again, because of historical racist practice in the city of Miami that divides neighborhoods, right, because of redlining, because of segregation, because of eminent domain practices, you have all of these neighborhoods are specifically situated west, and they're specifically neighborhoods where predominantly black communities have existed because we were once a very segregated community. We still are a very segregated community, but we were segregated by design and government sanctioned, right?
Yeah. Shared lives in separate spaces is how H.T. Smith at FIU has described it. But Alex, how is the city of Miami and others thinking about kind of the racial history of this that has led to the segregation as it kind of tries to address affordable housing here in the 21st century?
I think some activists would push back and say they're not necessarily doing a good enough job at looking at the equity lens in this discussion. But basically, when I've talked to Jane and some people who work in the city, Jane Gilbert, the CRO.
Yeah. Chief Resiliency Officer.
Right, for the city of Miami. She has talked a little bit about how when they come up with these new plans and solutions and maybe policy prescriptions for some of this affordable housing issues, they want to have community groups come to the table and talk a little bit about how these unique communities are each affected and ways that they can still respect the like nature of the community and keep that going with more housing for them that they can afford.
When it comes to affordable housing, clearly focused on residential housing, but when it comes to the fabric of the community, Nadege, commercial properties are also affected. They're not immune to this at
all. Commercial properties, for example, we saw the largest displacement of mostly Haitian-owned businesses in Little Haiti not just a few months ago.
Yep.
That's a new development project underway, but there were about just over a dozen businesses that had to move because they could never afford it. The same thing is happening in areas like Little Havana and Alapata. Mm-hmm. The huge produce market in Alapata is about to be a big development project. That's been around for over 30 years. And so we're seeing all of these community institutions, these community spaces that were very unique to that neighborhood are now starting to disappear as a result of development. And of course, climate is talked about in this way because these are areas that don't flood. Now, whether or not people are considering that on the front end, definitely the community is thinking about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I guess, you know, Alex and Nadej, you know, we're only going to be able to look back to answer this question in 5 years' time about the role of climate and the threat of rising seas playing with these with the property price trends that we're seeing in these neighborhoods, or just the economics of moving from neighboring areas that have seen the kind of price inflation over the last decade or so during this housing boom. And now it's just moving, it naturally just moving to neighborhoods looking for the lower price value.
And also, where are people going once they are displaced?
Exactly.
Right. That
right.
is part of this conversation.
Yep.
Because if you're moving people who sit on high elevation land, and because this land is now more valued, and now they're moving to areas where they may potentially be more at risk because yep. they're lower. And they also are the folks who will have the least amount of means to move again or move out of this place. So where are we pushing people to is also the question as we consider what is happening as it relates to rising sea levels. Are we putting them in a space that is dangerous potentially for them because it's also cheaper?
And one maybe cheaper today, but more expensive in the future because it could be more susceptible
to flooding.
And those
exactly.
risks,
yes.
Yeah, absolutely. 800-743-9576. Benny has a question, comment from Little Haiti. Benny, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. We run a small business out of Little Haiti. And earlier you were questioning what's driving the rise in rates. And it's simple. It's seen as the next Wynwood. It's seen as the next design district area. It's just one bit a little further north. Whereas 5 and 10 years ago, we had our rents much cheaper. Now it's they've grown staggering because it's seen as the next area for development.
Yeah. Yeah. Benny, does it concern you, though, is the economy growth seems to be slowing down a little bit? All the gyrations in the stock market are what they are. But if it's the last option now, does it mean it's going to fall the hardest first then potentially? Does that concern you?
Well, I'm no economist, but I know that we've watched the downtown and midtown city skyline grow in 2008 through 2014 when we were in a recession.
Yeah.
Miami is a desirable location, like George Perez says. People are going to build here anyway. They're going to come here anyway, and I don't think anyone's truly immune. But Miami seems to weather the storm, as we should say, a little better than other areas.
Benny from Little Haiti, thanks for calling. Thanks for listening here on the South Florida Roundup. Alex Harris, what's the next step for the city of Miami as it launches this kind of undefined study about climate gentrification?
The first step is to identify which areas should be studied. So traditionally, think about low-income, high-elevation areas like Alapata, Liberty City, Little Haiti. But Jane Gilbert, the city's chief resilience officer, told me that she's also considering looking at other areas just to see, you know, how does sea level rise affect every neighborhood? It's not just these specific ones. How does it affect affordable housing everywhere? With a special focus on kind of these areas that are brought up whenever you talk about climate gentrification.
And Nadej, for you, climate gentrification, where are the places to watch?
Definitely all of the areas west of Northwest 2nd Avenue in the city of Miami, which, again, historically the predominantly black neighborhoods. And I think what you also find in these neighborhoods is that people have community memory, right? We do a really bad job talking about the history of the city of Miami and the role government has played in displacing black residents over time, never with any kind of real remedy. So you had I-95 that just obliterated right. Overtown. Overtown has not recovered from that to date, right? You have the Railroad Shop, Colored Edition, a neighborhood that was near Alapata that was established in the 1920s. The city of Miami voted to evict everyone who lived there through eminent domain. And that area where families lived became an all-white school. Those black families were never moved into another place. There was never any remedy. And so I think when you consider the history of Miami and how black residents have been treated in the city of Miami, both as homeowners and as renters, that there's a lot of community memory. These families still exist and they're still here today. This was not a distant future.
No, even more recently, public housing issues in Liberty City, moving families
Scott
out.
Scott Carver, for example, was a huge one, right?
Right.
So when we talk about, okay, you're going to study this thing, I think one of the biggest questions for these communities that have always been under pressure and are still under pressure is what are going to be the remedies? Because we have seen again and again in the past that historically black communities have been displaced with no remedy.
Yeah. And Alex, are those communities at the table in a real way as the city embarks upon this this study, this research?
Some people would say no, and I think some people in those communities would say no. I think it'll be more clear as we move forward and see, like, when they start holding these meetings, who they're going to invite. Are they inviting the same people they've always invited? Are they going to bring more people to the table who have become sort of their own activists in their own communities and have kind of created a carved out a space for themselves to advocate for their own neighborhoods?
And when it comes to the bond money, which is driving this right now, what are the next steps for that? This was just the first tranche of borrowing. It was $40 million of $200 million?
Yes. And so we're just going to kind of see those projects roll out as they go. They have to be approved by pretty much everyone, and they have to kind of tick all of these special boxes for individual categories of where they go. But we'll see more affordable housing money. We'll see more sea level rise fighting money and other big projects as moving forward.
Alex Harris covers the climate for our partner, the Miami Herald. She's with us from our studios inside the Herald newsroom out in Doral. Nadej Green, a reporter with us here at WLRN. Ladies, thanks so much.
Thank you for having
Appreciate
us.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Still to come on our program, a decade-old deal to help save the Everglades is officially dead. That comes up next on the South Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again and always for listening and supporting WLRN. A land deal dating back to the Great Recession that would have restored the Everglades' historic flow south died quietly this month. The South Florida Water Management District voted to cancel the option of buying more than 100,000 acres of sugarland south of Lake Okeechobee. That farmland blocks water from flowing south into Everglades National Park. Now, this Sugarland deal was crafted by former Governor Charlie Crist back in 2008. The decision to end the deal was approved 2 years ago in an effort to build a reservoir south of Lake O. So let's talk about all of this here, kind of what has led to this and where things go from here to try to restore the flow south. Miami Herald's environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich back with us. Always great to have you, Jenny. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So this decision, as you wrote about it, it was 10 years in the making. This was announced with great fanfare and signing under a banyan tree, I think, this deal, this option for the state of Florida to buy thousands and thousands of acres of sugarcane land to help restore the flow of the water south. The Great Recession hit. A new governor came in. The option to buy the land was not followed through with. And then officially walk us through what happened within the last couple of weeks.
So in the last couple of weeks, you had basically that last option, which in the EAA reservoir deal passed
the Everglades agriculture area, right?
Right. Sorry about the acronyms. As part of that law, legislators said, we're also going to get rid of this final option. That law, you know, had a lot of chefs in creating it, and so that was part of the deal. Was another part of the deal was that the sugar farmers would be allowed to continue farming the land that is slated for the reservoir until construction actually starts.
So help us understand kind of two things here that have happened, right? There's the Charlie Crist 2008 land option deal, which was to restore the flow of Lake Okeechobee water and Everglades water south into the Everglades. And then we had the lost summer of 2016, which led to the then leader of the Florida Senate, Joe Negron, to push for a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee to hold the water so that it wouldn't have to be spit out to the east and west coasts and feed the blue-green algae that we've seen. Two different problems there.
Right. And let me say that the reservoir was always in the original plan to restore the Everglades. It was envisioned as the 60,000 acre shallow reservoir south of the lake, which would have made it big enough and shallow enough to hold all the water that would not only help not eliminate, but help reduce the discharges out to the coast, but also provide water to the southern end where marshes are wilting and peat is collapsing and
Seagrass is dying in Florida Bay because it's too salty.
Right, yeah. Right. You need the system originally worked in a way that you had this massive sheet flow that flowed slowly and gently out into Florida Bay.
Yeah.
And then, basically the EAA, the agricultural area, was over the years, you know, when that was drained to allow for that farming, it got in the way of that sheet flow. So all this effort, all these years of effort has been to try and restore that. And
here we are. So the option to buy that land from 10 years ago, that's gone, that's dead, that's buried, that contract is null and void, it's no longer in force, that's not going to happen.
Right.
The Negron Reservoir Plan, which is still the law now in the state of Florida, those plans still are moving forward, although with some fits and starts. Right around Election Day, for instance, there was a story that the South Florida Water Management District was going to extend a lease for farmers to continue to use the same land that was supposed to begin to have the reservoir built on it.
Right. And again, that goes back to the way the law was written for the reservoir. Part of it was that farmers would continue to farm until actual construction started. Yeah. The holdup now, and this was an issue all through the design process, was the size and design of the reservoir. You know, the state and the feds are supposed to split the cost. The state has been saying, we need to move forward. We need to get this fixed. The coast can't take this regular seasonal awfulness. But I think the Corps, the engineers, are looking at this design saying, is this really going to work? Hmm. And are we really going to sign off on paying for half of it? So they are in the review process, and they're under a lot of pressure. A lot of the environmentalists, Senator Rubio, Mast, have written letters to the Assistant Secretary of the Army saying, you guys better not hold this thing up. But again, the engineers are saying, do you want us to spend money on something that without knowing for sure how it's going to work?
The scientists are stepping in saying, let us make this decision, not the politicians here. Mast is the reference to Brian Mast, the former congressman for Northern Palm Beach and Martin County, who has now led the transition team for Governor-elect Ron DeSantis, who, of course, made environment a pillar issue for his successful Republican candidacy. So does that calculus change at all?
With the
new governor coming in.
Well, I think that is, I think people are hoping that the new governor will put more pressure and you know, get it done quickly. I have heard talk, I'm hesitant to even say this, that they're aware that the size of the reservoir is too small, that this new governor may have some...
But that's in the law, right?
That is in the law, but it doesn't mean that there can't be more projects. I mean, they revise these projects all the time.
Sure, yeah.
So maybe that's the hope, that there's some wiggle room, that the feds can manage to get more land than the state was able to, because the state and the state's politicians were under more pressure than maybe federal agencies would be.
Water and politics and the Everglades here on the South Florida Roundup. Your calls, your questions, 800-743-9576. Send us a tweet at WLRN. Jenny Stiletovich with our partner, the Miami Herald, covers the environment, is steeped in all things Everglades. Certainly, 800-743-9576. So let me go back to this just a few months ago when the Water Management District was going to allow farmers to continue to grow sugarcane on this land that was destined to hold water, not sugarcane. Is that deal still in play? Can this land still be part of the agriculture community while we wait to hear from the Corps of Engineers and others involved?
Right. Well, so part of this lease deal that the Water Management District cut with the sugar is that the ability to cancel the lease in 20 months with 4 months notice. So their thinking was the planning and design and construction of these projects is usually so long that there's no way we're going to get to the point of construction before 2 years. So that gives us plenty of time. The environmentalists are saying, hey, we managed to get this reservoir through. There are things that we could be doing before a contract is actually signed for construction. If next year rolls around and we have these awful releases again, why can't that land be used for some kind of storage feature? Why can't, you know, be more flexible just to bring some relief to the coast?
One thing we haven't mentioned is money. These are significantly, these projects come with big, big price tags, but with Florida voters approving the amendment several years ago about earmarking money for the environment, is that the source of funds for the state dollars here?
Right. Well, and part of the decision that the Water Management District made was the implementing legislation for the EA for the Everglades Reservoir provided $64 million to get started, but that was all part of the lease deal. It was, if you're going to get this money, then you need to follow the letter of the law, which says extend the leases for the farmers, get rid of the option to buy mm-hmm. the sugar land. You know, and so the district is saying our hands were tied by this law. Environmentalists are saying we have a new governor in the governor's mansion in Tallahassee. You know, hold off. And that was kind of the flashpoint back in November, is the vote occurred 2 days after the election.
Right. 800-743-9576, Homestead, South Dade County. Stephen on line one. Go ahead, Stephen. Thanks for calling and listening.
Hi, I just wanted to make two quick points. You said that Congressman Mass was a former congressman. Just wanted to say he's still a congressman.
Thank you for that correction. Appreciate
it. Number two is down here in Homestead Everglades National Park, we see that the non-movement on getting the water to flow south is affecting our bay only 20 minutes away down at Flamingo Park right there on Florida Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And we would love to see some movement get done with a new governor and a new legislature.
Stephen, how's it affecting the area down in Flamingo?
It's still dry, more forested area, because the farther south you get a little bit more pine, rockland trees and other things like that, mangrove swamps. And then we also have the fractitious canal zone.
Mm-hmm.
Down this way, but we do have plenty of grass spots that have been helped by the raising of US 41 on 8th Street there past FIU.
Yeah.
But we still need a lot more water to flow under there for it to be more effective.
Stephen, thanks for checking in there in Homestead, South Dade County, and thanks for that correction on Brian Mast, currently a congressman, not a former congressman. To Stephen's point, Jenny Stiletovich, though, when it comes to the flow of the water south, again, back to this original Charlie Crist era deal, that was among the designs of it. Does the reservoir, the Negron Reservoir Law, does it address the flow south?
Well, so it's supposed to provide the water to increase the flow south. I mean, that it was partly pitched as a solution to the Treasure
Coast.
The blue-green
algae,
it really is more of a benefit to the southern end. Huh. It really is intended to provide more water to the southern end, which, you know, right now conditions are really dry.
We're in a drought in South Florida,
right,
believe it or not.
Right,
yeah.
And so without those freshwater flows, the bay, you know, it's half rainwater, half overland flows.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to get in trouble again, like it did a few years ago, where they had these massive seagrass die-offs after, and that was following a drought.
So where do things stand right now with the Corps of Engineers? Much was on their plate, the scientists and the engineer, the civil engineers designing this, in terms of looking at those plans and having to get approval before Congress opens up the bank account.
Right. So they're in the middle of taking a closer look at the design of the reservoir. They are also in the middle of coming up, I hate to even use this term, but a combined operational plan with figuring out how to move the water under the bridges, because they have finished construction on the 1 mile section,
right,
and the 2 mile is opened up now, but they can't start moving water through until everybody agrees on how that water is going to move through there, what time of year. It's not just the quantity, it's the where it goes, when it goes, the timing.
All about the plumbing in South Florida. Jenny Stiletovich with us, covering the environment for our part in the Miami Herald. Great to see you again, and you got your sweater for the first day of winter, I see. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us today.
Thank you.
Jenny Stiletovich with our partner of the Miami Herald, covering the environment. Finally, on the South Florida Roundup this week.
Down to Florida.
Today marks the first day of winter.
To the Sunshine State.
May not feel like that here in South Florida, but we have our own ways of marking the season.
Every day in Florida.
Some of our listeners wrote to us on Twitter, at WLRN is our handle, about what makes a South Florida winter. Danny said paralyzed iguanas. You know, if it gets too cold, they freeze up in those trees. Of course, then they warm up. Rodrigo said he looks forward to riding his bike without breaking a sweat. For Sky and Eddie, it's eating churros and hot chocolate. And Catherine wrote us how we valiantly survive hurricane season to get to the best part of living here. Winter in South Florida is our reward. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado, our digital director. News director, Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, editorial director. Director of radio operations, Peter J. Meritz. Director of radio programming and technical supervisor, Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and have a great winter. Every day in Florida.